Okay, so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about teaching and learning in an era of disruptive innovation. And I'm going to focus a lot on the work of, I'm going to pull some ideas from a professor at Harvard named Clayton Christensen. He's written about disruptive innovation in the corporate world, in the education world, in the healthcare world, and so on. And I think it's important to start out by understanding what a disruptive innovation is. Okay, so I'm going to give you some examples that I think will probably make this pretty concrete for you. So we used to have these, and then they got replaced by these, which got replaced by these, which got replaced by these, right? And every new technology disrupted the one before it and pretty much completely replaced it. We used to have computers that looked like this. Now they look like, then they looked like that. Then they started to look like that. And now we're looking more like this and like that. Okay? We used to use film cameras. Now we're all digital. We used to use paper maps. Now we're heading towards GPS. And it's not just gadgets and tools. You know, it's also services and companies. So, for example, Sears used to be the dominant retailer. Then it was Walmart. And increasingly, it's Amazon, right? So we're seeing these kind of shifts. Newspaper classifieds being replaced by Craigslist and so on. The important thing to recognize here is that disruptive innovations change the game. They replace the existing paradigm with something new, or they severely diminish the existing paradigm in such a way that it is in no way dominant the way it used to be. So I'm going to talk about disruptive innovations in the context of three of the main functions of schools, and of course schools fulfill many important functions. But three of the key ones are that we want to prepare our graduates to be socially functional, right? We want to generally prepare them for the world in which they're going to live. We want them to master the information landscape in which they currently live and are going to live. In other words, that academic focus, we want them to be academically successful, information fluent, information literate, and so on. This whole notion that every child should be educated in the information space that they're going to operate. And finally, we want them to be economically productive. In other words, we want them to get jobs, we want them to be contributors to our economy and our society and so on. And what we're finding is that these desktops, these laptops, these mobile phones, these iPods, these GPS devices, these digital cameras, these camcorders, these online spaces like blogs and wikis and podcasts, online video sites, online mapping, social bookmarking, et cetera, that they're creating for us a new information landscape that's very different from the one that went before. And the last time this happened to us was back in the day of the printing press. Right? Before the printing press was invented, most ordinary citizens were illiterate. They didn't have the need to read because they didn't have access to text. Manuscripts were handwritten, they were laboriously copied by monks, they were expensive, and the only people that could afford them were the wealthy or the powerful. And to the extent that the average citizen needed to know something, they were informed by the king's messengers, by the priests, and so on. In other words, there were third-party intermediaries that translated information for the average citizen. What the printing press did was it made information accessible to the masses for the first time ever. It made text accessible to the masses. And what we found out very quickly as societies were that it was going to be important for most people to be able to read, right? That it was worthwhile for us to have the ability to access those texts directly, that we no longer needed third-party intermediaries between us and information, between us and texts. And this was sort of a big deal, right? This is what the Reformation was all about, was removing those intermediaries so that we could read that stuff ourselves and decide for ourselves what it meant and what we thought about it, etc. We're now seeing a similar shift with these new digital technologies and this new information landscape, where instead of removing the third-party intermediaries between us and information that others provide, we're recognizing that it's going to be important for most of our graduates to have the ability to be functional content creators, to be publishers, to be authors, and so on. It used to be expensive to be a publisher. If you think about the costs that are associated with creating a book, the ink, the paper, the glue, the binding, the distribution networks, the marketing, the author fees, and so on. It's very expensive to get your word out through books. But now, it's very inexpensive. In fact, it costs $0 to write something, get it up on the web, and literally have the potential to reach tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people. Right? You want your text seen by people? It's very easy nowadays. And the same thing holds true for music, and videos, and movies, and so on. So what we're finding is that we all now have a voice, that we no longer live in an information push-out world. When publishing was expensive, only the dominant players could afford to be content creators, to be content publishers. So corporations, media companies, large associations like NEA, the government, universities, and so on, they were the ones that had the ability to create content and to be publishers, and the rest of us passively received it. That environment is no longer in existence. We all now have a voice. We all now can be content publishers, so that even when the big entities continue to push information out to us, we also have the ability to complement that, to supplement that, to push back on it, to rebut that, to contradict it, to mix it and mash it up in different ways, to add value to existing communication mechanisms and so on. It's much more of a dialogue and a community and a conversation now. It's multimodal. It's not unidirectional, where we all receive information that others push out to us. But now it's multimodal, and it's more of a web of interaction. This is a big deal, right? What we're getting at here is we're altering the fundamental ways that we connect with each other, that we communicate with each other, that we share with each other. In other words, we're altering what it means to be social. And when you get at what it means to be social, that's huge, because at our essence, we are social beings, right? That's what humans are. And we're changing all the interfaces and interactions and connection spaces and tools and so on about what it means to be social. So this is kind of a big deal. Not only do we all have a voice, we're also hyper-connected, right? So through tools like Facebook and MySpace or Twitter or more professional sites like LinkedIn, younger sites like Webkinz or Club Penguin, self-created social networks like Ning, Even Amazon book review sites or Shelfari book review communities, or even, you know, travel advisory sites like TripAdvisor, where we come together and we communicate and interact around things that we're interested in, that we care about. We are all now connected. And it's not just through our desktops and laptops, but it's increasingly mobile, right? That we can do this from anywhere at any time through our portable devices. In other words, anytime, anywhere, content production, collaboration, connection, and so on. So, big shift. We all now have a voice, and we can find each other, we can share with each other, we can connect with each other, we can collaborate with each other. And that doesn't sound like it's necessarily a big deal, except that it's destroying the newspaper industry and the magazine industry, the music industry, radio, television, movies, books, and how we read are going through fundamental changes. We're having to rethink maps, which are disappearing, travel agencies are disappearing, how we think about travel is different, how we do business and personal finance and money management is different, how we think about medicine and health is going through a complete revolution because of these information tools and spaces, the postal service is struggling to survive, and you can look at the last political presidential election and see that politics is vastly different than it was just a few years ago, universities are struggling to adapt to the new paradigm. In other words, every single sector of our society that's oriented around information is going through a complete upheaval because we're experiencing an information revolution, right? And of course, P12 schools are also information organizations at our heart. That's what we're all about. So we have to recognize as educators, as school systems, the transformational aspects of all this. We can't pretend that we're going to be immune from the same forces that are reshaping every other information-oriented sector of our society. We've got another big disruptive innovation that's occurring. It's called the globalization of our economy. What we're seeing in the U.S. and other westernized economies, we're seeing the disappearance of physical manual labor. In other words, that... Well, I'm not sure why. So on the side screen, there's a red line. But on the front screen, there's not. I'm not quite sure why. That's right. So that's actually pretty interesting. So recognize at least that we're seeing the disappearance of the factory job in America, right? That those are the jobs that in the past traditionally didn't require a lot of specialized skill or talent or knowledge or education. You literally could go down to the local factory and get a job, and with a couple of days of training, you could be off and running. Well, because those jobs didn't require any specialized skill or talent or education or training, literally anybody could do them, right? You wouldn't even have to have a high school diploma. You could go down and get a job. Those jobs are disappearing from the U.S. economy because they can be done by anybody, literally anybody. And where are the bodies cheapest? They're cheapest in the developing world. So we're seeing that kind of work disappear unless it's location dependent. So the person who builds your house, who repairs your water heater, who puts new shingles on your roof, etc., that's location dependent work, right? The person who drives a cab, who cuts your hair, that's location dependent work. But if it can be offshored, it will be offshored in terms of manufacturing and so on. We're also seeing the disappearance of routine cognitive work, that lighter green arrow, that lighter green line. What's routine cognitive work? Well, the people who interpret x-rays or MRIs are doing routine cognitive work. They do the same mental tasks over and over again. People who do bookkeeping is essentially routine cognitive work. The people who do data entry is basically routine cognitive work. So too are people who work in call centers or customer support or technical support. The people who do hotel or airline check-ins. The people who take catalog orders and so on. Repetitive mental tasks. We're seeing that that work is also disappearing because our digital technologies allow us to send it overseas and have that information travel back and forth at the speed of light. So whether it's over the phone or whether it's over the internet, that work can be done anywhere. It's not location dependent, right? Computer programming, legal research, and so on. So where are the growth areas in the American economy? It's around non-routine cognitive work, right? It's this stuff, critical thinking, problem solving, being innovative and creative, being complex communicators, the kind of work that you guys do every single day. This kind of non-routine cognitive work is the kind of stuff that can't be replaced by unskilled labor and can't be replaced by folks overseas. What we're also seeing is that we're seeing that routine cognitive work is also being replaced by software, right? So every time you make your own airline reservation online, you've taken away some travel agent's job. Every time that you check in at a hotel or an airline with a kiosk, you've taken away some frontline service professional's job. Every time you drop in your mortgage numbers into a web form and you hit calculate, you've eliminated some routine cognitive mortgage application evaluation person's job. You can think about legal software that allows you to create legal documents. You know, there's a huge segment of the legal industry that's routine cognitive work. You can think about tax preparation software. There's a huge segment of the accounting CPA tax preparation industry that's routine cognitive work, and so on. If it can be reduced to an algorithm, we can create software that does it, and that segment of your job or that entire job is gone. So this is the stuff that can't be replaced by software. So Richard Florida says that you can divide the American workforce into four groups. And again, that red line's not showing up. I don't know why. But the first group is what he calls the agricultural class. Notice that in 1900, almost 40% of American workers were involved in agriculture. That's now down to less than 2%. The second group is the working class, those classic manufacturing jobs. That's that bright blue line on the screen. Peaked right after World War II. Has been on the decline ever since. The third class, the service professions or helping professions, a steady climb, peaked in 1980. That's the advent of the personal computer, now tipping back down. And then the line you can't see is the growth of the, what he calls the creative class, the people who do non-routine cognitive work, those green line abstract skills on a regular basis, like all of us. And we've seen a sharp uptick in that, starting with 1980. Those are the jobs that are facilitated by tech, not replaced by them. If you take that line chart and turn it into a stacked bar chart, it looks like this. Notice the decline of agriculture down at the bottom. This computer just doesn't like to show red for some reason. I don't know. They're anti-red. The non-existent bars up at the top that you can't see is the growth of the creative class. In 1900, only 10% of the American workforce needed those green line abstract cognitive skills. It took 70 years for a 10% increase, but only 30 years for the next 10% increase. As of 2008, it's estimated that number is up to 35-36%. In other words, it continues to accelerate, driven by digital technologies and the web. If you look at, so this is data from Kentucky, you can see that the growth areas in the Kentucky economy are around information-oriented professions, business and finance, education and health, service providing, etc. What's declining? Manufacturing, goods producing, agriculture, etc. Those same figures you can replicate anywhere in the U.S. Nice steady growth in terms of number of jobs around information-oriented professions. Manufacturing is on the decline. We're taking a big hit as those jobs go overseas. So those same trends that I showed in Kentucky are true in just about every state. So ask yourself, can a computer do my job faster? Can somebody overseas do my job cheaper? If so, your job is gone. What the new Commission on the Skills of the American Workforce has said that if all goes well, the bulk of the work that's done in the U.S. will be creative, non-routine cognitive work. Because any work that's routine, that's done by people or machines, will occur in less developed countries or will be replaced by software. So we got a big problem, however, right? If we remind ourselves of these three functions, these three important functions of schools, we see that we've got a dilemma, right? Our schools were designed for an era in which 3/4 of our population went into agricultural manufacturing jobs. Those same institutions, those same structures, those same pedagogical models are now operating in an era where 3/4 of our population is in creative class and upper end service class professions. So what we're finding is that our system where we take kids' individual uniquenesses, we shove them through the convergent funnel, and we say, spit back to us the right answer. Our system where we say, we're going to put boundaries around this limitless information space, we're going to create a standardized curriculum, and that if you master all of it, that you're going to be okay for the rest of your life. That this system where research shows us that about 80 to 85% of the work that kids do on a day-to-day classroom basis in their classrooms is factual recall and low-level procedural knowledge. In other words, routine cognitive work. But that system does the kind of stuff that you can find on Google in about half a second. That this kind of current system isn't very well adapted for the needs of a digital global age. So this is a nice classroom. It's neat. It's orderly. It's colorful. Got a little bit of tech in the room. Teacher's delighted because the kids are raising their hands and participating. But the bottom line is the pedagogical model of this classroom is the same as that of 1890. The teacher is the focal point of the room. Kids are in rows and columns. They primarily do seat work at their desk. Occasionally one gets to go up and show their work at the front. The biggest difference between the rooms is probably the color of the board at the front. As David Warlick says, no generation in history has ever been so thoroughly prepared for the industrial age. Takeaways from all this. Implications for schools and for educators. Recognize that we're facing multiple disruptive innovations at the same time, right? And I highlighted some of the big ones. Our current system is not a given. It evolved to meet a certain need, which was to educate mass numbers of people for an industrial society, a society that is increasingly disappearing from the U.S., being replaced by a knowledge economy, right? And what we know from our lessons of disruptive innovations is that good organizations with good people disappear if they don't adapt to disruptive environments, right? And what we also know is that it's very hard for existing dominant organizations to adapt to a disruptive environments, right? Think about all the companies that used to exist that have been replaced by new ones, right? All those disruptive models that I showed you up front, right? The dominant players are gone, being replaced by something else. It's very hard to take an organization that has fine-tuned itself to do A for a century and all of a sudden expect it to do B and do it well. And also we have to recognize this is sneaking up on most school organizations. We're doing this, right? If you look at the impact of these transformational technologies, if we look at the impact of our wholly revised information landscape, if we look at the impact of the new workforce needs that we have in a competitive global economy, for the most part, they've existed at the margins of how we do school, not the core. There's a reason why, right? It's because we look at a lot of this stuff, particularly in the technological arena, and we say, well, it's not good enough right now, right? It's not as good as what we're currently doing. But the problem, the lesson that we learned from disruptive innovations is that they get better, right? They work on the fringes, on the outside, on the periphery, and they get better. And at some point, they pass the good enough line. And as soon as they become good enough, we move over wholesale. And that's why they're disruptive innovations. That's why they replace the thing that happened before, right? The cell phone was terrible at the beginning, but it got better. And at some point, it started to replace landlines. And eventually, it becomes the new dominant paradigm. And the old paradigm disappears. So a lot of this has not crossed the visibility threshold for most of you yet, right? It's proceeding at exponential paces. We're changing at exponential rates, but you haven't seen it yet because it hasn't crossed your visibility threshold. It's changing at an exponential rate, but it's still low enough that it hasn't crossed your horizon. We're down in there somewhere. But the lesson of an exponential curve, of course, is that most of the change happens right at the very end, the big changes, right? So the challenge for us as educators is to recognize that we're moving toward the knee of the curve. And for many school organizations and many educators, they're going to be over on the right-hand side somewhere where the steep incline is, and they're going to look back and say, what the heck happened to us? Because they weren't forward-thinking enough. The time to make changes is not after you hit the knee of the curve. It's well before you hit the knee of the curve. By the time you're up on the right-hand side of that exponential line, it's too late. You've been replaced or diminished by something else. So, NEA is functioning in the space a little bit, right? You're founding members of the Partnership for 21st Century Skills. You had this great report that came out in 2008 that focused on stuff, but for the most part, you're not really living in this space, right? These major technological and societal and workforce transformations that are changing all of society as we know it, particularly every information-oriented segment of society, you all aren't really paying much attention to that. If you look at your legislative policy priorities, for example, other than a little nod towards E-rate funding, you've got nothing, right? You've got bookcase. So, I think one of the challenges for you is to re-envision how are you going to be relevant to the transformational forces that are reshaping all of society. Right, you can't continue to pretend that schools are going to be immune from all this. Also, speaking specifically for NEA and teacher unions, I want to highlight two things just very quickly. One is that you have to recognize that some of your teaching functions will be replaced. They're going to be replaced by people who are overseas, or they're going to be replaced by software. Right? You can think about things like tutoring, personal assistance of students, essay grading, lecturing, ongoing assessment, and so on. Many of those things can be done quite well by software or by people overseas. Right? And to the extent that that happens, you're either going to be freed up to do something else, some more non-routine, more complex cognitive work, which would be great, or what's also likely to happen is that you're going to be replaced. Right? They're going to need fewer of you. Also, we have to recognize that to the extent that teaching is replaced by software or that it moves online, right, thus removing the geographic connections and ties that you have with each other, that union membership and union affiliations are going to be weakened, right, that our feelings of connection with other teachers are not as strong when we teach in online spaces. We don't feel as connected to the other people who are teaching for that virtual school, for example, or to people who are doing functions overseas or software. And that, of course, has some implications in terms of membership base and your financial power and your political power and so on. So, the 21st century is here. In fact, it's been here for a decade already. In January, it'll be a decade old. We're still talking about giving kids 21st century skills. It's probably time that we started moving on that. Right? And if we don't figure this out, either that change is going to be mandated on you from outside, or something else is going to emerge that better meets the needs of kids and families and society. Thank you.